House Committee on Judiciary coming to order. Today is Tuesday, April 11th, 2017. We are going to roll over House Bill 3279, which is a labor, modifies definition of labor contract.
Just to tomorrow.
Till tomorrow. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2793.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For 2793, you would want to focus on the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the measure. It requires a defendant upon conviction of commercial sexual solicitation to notify the court of all licenses, certificates, permits, and registrations the person holds. It requires the court to then notify all of these entities. The defendant is subject to contempt of court for knowingly failing to provide this information. It also requires the entities issuing these licenses to notify applicants that applicants must agree to comply with this provision. It also revokes hunting and angling licenses or tags from the State Department of Fish and Wildlife for 1 year. It creates and requires defendants to complete a John school and also creates a diversion program. Finally, it requires a suspension of 6 months for driving privileges upon conviction unless the court finds compelling circumstances. We do not yet have the fiscal or revenue impact statements.
Thank you. Representative Huffman and Senator Tatum, please.
Chair Barker.
Yeah.
With permission, they ask.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Committee, John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59 and co-convener of the CSEC work group. Senator Taylor and I are before you today to follow up on a previous hearing that we had on House Bills 2141 and 2142. Those two bills sought to suspend either professional licenses or driver licenses if one was convicted of commercial sexual solicitation, compelling or promoting prostitution, or purchasing sex with a minor. Not long after our meeting on those bills, Committee Counsel Chana Newell convened stakeholders to discuss ways to work from the underlying philosophy beyond the two previous bills while addressing some of the concerns that were brought before the committee. There were quite a few people in her office that day, including the Department of Justice and the Judicial Department and the Oregon State Bar, and so there was quite a complement of folks in the room. Oh, and Gail Meyer from OCDLA. She had a bad cold that day, though, so we did all feel sorry for her in spite of that. But as neither 2141 or 2142 had relating clauses that would fit the entirety of the new concepts, council helped us identify a placeholder bill where we could fit in the changes via an amendment, which is why we have House Bill 2793 with a Dash 1 amendment before you today. The amendment narrows the scope of who these penalties will apply to, offers a diversion option, and also addresses some due process concerns that were raised previously. And I would like to say that some of the committee members actually that were not in the room that day had talked to Senator Taylor and I privately, and some of those suggestions like diversion were worked into the amendment. This amendment was only contemplated this morning, and so we worked through the review process. Well, Senator Taylor will cover that. I, for sake of time, I want to jump and read District Attorney Multnomah County Rod Underhill's letter that he sent this morning, but I know our inboxes get full of stuff and I don't want to assume that you all read it, so I'm going to read it really quickly. It's fairly short. Dear Chair Barker and members of the committee, I urge you to support House Bill 2793. Human trafficking, specifically sex trafficking, is a serious problem throughout Oregon and the United States. In the 8 years that I've been working sex trafficking cases, a common issue has emerged in combating sex trafficking, reducing demand. Deterring buyers from purchasing minors and adults reduces demand. Research regarding buyers has shown that public awareness, employers, loved ones find out losing a car or other possessions and or John schools deters and reduces demand. It's funny how stuff like that being made public tends to make you think twice about your actions. allowing the court to contact licensing and permitting agencies, suspending an offender's driving privileges, and requiring education are all sound means towards deterring individuals from engaging in purchasing sex and reducing recidivism for those caught. It goes on a little bit, but that's the core points of it, and District Attorney Underhill, again, does support 2793 with the dash one amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Huffman, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. The new legislation before you in the Dash 1 Amendment makes some substantive changes to the original concepts. These penalties will apply only to the crime of commercial sexual solicitation, which happens when a person pays or offers to pay a fee to engage in sexual conduct or sexual contact directly addressing the demand end of commercial sex. Also, as the crime is a misdemeanor, largely individuals who are being convicted of this crime would not go to prison. Purchasing sex with a minor, compelling and promoting prostitution, which is where previously in the concepts are felonies, and as such typically result in a prison sentence. Therefore, revoking or suspending a license would be a moot point. And issuing these suspensions at release would run the risk of interfering with efforts made to better assist the reentry population. The Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 2793 offer a diversion option, and part of that diversion includes completion of a program known as John School, a program that has been operating rather successfully in Multnomah County. That option is available to first-time offenders. If an offender waives diversion, or it is not their first offense, and they are convicted of the crime, they would then submit a list of licenses, certificates, permits, and registrations to the court, and DOJ will facilitate a notification process with the issuing entities so that they are notified of the conviction. The court will also revoke hunting and angling licenses as well as its tags. John School again may be ordered should the defendant receive probation as part of the sentence. Additionally, unless the court finds a significant reason otherwise, the court may suspend an individual's driver's privileges for 6 months. Again, this part has been changed regarding the driver's licenses so that a judge would be able to decide if that needed to be altered in some way. Again, we are hoping to quickly work with stakeholders on this concept to address any areas of confusion or concern. We are happy to field the questions, and we have other experts in the room to ask answer some of the other questions if needed. So just wanted to.
Thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee.
Thank you,
Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. And I realize that this amendment for some of us on the committee caught us a little bit off guard because we had a hearing on this previously, and all of a sudden it's back. This amendment really attempts to deal with the things that were brought up in the previous hearing and did pull people together to discuss this. One thing I wanted to comment on about it, apart from I really appreciate the diversion option, but one thing that we've heard frequently in this committee is, Rep. Greenlick, where you tend to bring up at times, you know, does this increased penalty reduce the likeliness that the person will offend? And I was thinking as Rep. Taylor was reading through her description here, the old saying, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you. Well, that really is the goal of this. That if there is, you know, on this second offense, if you didn't learn the first time in diversion and so forth, that, yeah, if it takes shaming publicly for the person to stop doing this, then maybe that's what we should do. And that's what the whole goal here is, not to equate necessarily hunting and fishing to prostitution, but or purchasing sex, but really to say, look, we need to figure out a way to deter your behavior. And this is a way that we think publicly that people might pay attention.
Okay, thank you, Chair. You're right.
This only applies in the second offense. Is that what I just heard Senator Taylor say?
It is.
Or if the person refuses diversion in the first.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I would have to double check, but that was my understanding of what the intent was. Maybe my colleagues can clarify.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, committee counsel, maybe you can clarify, but I believe that is correct.
Yes, thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick, you do have the option of the diversion program on the first offense. Obviously, a person could decline to enter diversion, and then all of those consequences with driver's license and certifications would be applicable. Or if the person doesn't already qualify for diversion, there are within the Dash 1 Amendment It sets forth what the requirements are to be eligible for the diversion program. And I would have to pull those up. Obviously, one of them was that you haven't been through the diversion program before.
Well, I don't think the answer to the question. Does it only apply to the second offense, or is it?
You may enter. So you have a choice to enter diversion.
I don't see that.
Mr. Chair, we could have Aaron not come up if you'd like.
Yeah, Aaron can answer that.
Okay, and please.
Okay, thank you.
I've got a question for them.
Okay, please, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Freeze.
Aaron, can you come up? Please?
So.
I'm not sure. Who are you asking the question?
Somebody that has an answer. So it might be you, Representative Stark. So a bit of an awkward question here, but I'm going to ask it. I'm going to go there. They, for the diversion, they have to complete a John school. What is a John school? And is somebody in Eastern Oregon going to have the same access to this school as somebody in Portland?
So I'm going to go ahead and ask. I think Kevin Neely's here from the.
No.
So we're going to. So he's not asking to come. So my understanding from JR couldn't be here today. So what John School is, it is a program that's been established. I don't know how many years it's been in place, but it is a one-day program, is my understanding, and you are brought in and you learn. The Johns are taught what the impact is of their actions. And so recognizing that what this does to often women's lives, and in some cases, minors. The John, part of the diversion is that they have to pay for the program themselves. And I believe it's $1,000 or $1,500, something like that. And they have to pay for that. The state does not pay for that, and the court system doesn't. The public is not paying for that. And there was a lot of discussion about what to do versus rural areas versus in the Multnomah County. And the overall consensus was, and I'm going to be really frank here, and I apologize, Chair Barker, for being so frank, but the discussion, what we kind of came to is that if one is willing to pay for sexual acts, then, and they are able to come up with that money for that, then perhaps they can travel to Multnomah County to pay for John School themselves.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, as the representative in the room that represents the furthest point in Oregon away from Multnomah County and the John School, I was the one that came up with and made the comment that it's fine with me if they have to pay for it out of their own pocket at their own expense. If we never get other John schools, which there is an effort, I understand, being looked at to try to get these diversion points around the state, if that never happens, I'm okay with somebody from Wheeler County or Grant County having to drive to Portland at their own expense and pay for the John School. I feel strongly enough about this.
Please.
Thank you. I have no love for sex trafficking at all, but we're also talking about something where somebody could ultimately lose their driver's license too,
and
or that would be subsequent of the diversion. So I just want to go on record. Multnomah County is not the center of the state, so everything should not be in Multnomah County. Let's get something going someplace else. It costs money to do it everywhere. We need to have these north of or west of Salem. Just do. Or not have these at all because we don't have a problem.
Can I pull up on
Yeah,
that?
Please.
I have a question, and I don't know if it's a follow-up to Representative Springer's, because I was having the same thought. And my question is so there's a definition in the bill of a John School, but is there any sort of certification? Is there any sort of curriculum, or is it just any school or any program intended to educate? So do we have any standards, and do we have any data on the Multnomah County program to see whether or not it works?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, first of all, for the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director with the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. I sat on this work group that was predominantly staffed by Chana Newell, and since she's not here, I'm going to try to step in on those technical questions as best I'm able. There is some data about John schools nationally. I don't have data about Multnomah County in particular. There's no licensing requirement envisioned by the bill. In fact, the definition John school is any course, class, or program intended to educate and prevent recidivism of persons who have been arrested, charged, or convicted under this section. In my read of Section 1, Sub 5, the decision about the appropriateness of the class would be made by the court, which might have some actual geographic flexibility as well, because that definition of John School is relatively broad. But no, I'm not aware of a licensing requirement, nor do I know who the licensing or accreditation agency would be.
Mr. Chair, can I ask? The question about whether this essentially applies to second offense or first offense, can you clarify that?
Yes. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, yes. I share the perception that the consequences that have been listed would apply only to those individuals who either declined diversion or have already gone through it. What I take that from is that the consequences sections, which are Section 1 and Section 5, Section 5 being the suspension of driver's license and Section 1 describing the other consequences, are all predicated on the fact of a conviction. If you enter into the diversion, which is outlined at Section 3, it says, and at subsection 3 of there, in order to enter the diversion, the court shall accept the defendant's plea of guilty, so or no contest, so there's the factual determination of guilt, but withhold the entry of a judgment of conviction, so that the event that would cause all of those consequences to attach is the conviction. That's withheld when you enter diversion. So you get that opportunity to go through diversion. If you complete it successfully, you're not convicted, and the charges are dismissed with prejudice, so they cannot be rebrought. If you either fail to complete diversion or you then reoffend, then you would pick up those conviction-driven consequences. So I do think that's accurate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we have people go through alcohol diversion, we have standards for those programs, right? And we have certain expectations. But am I hearing that we don't have that for the John School concept?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, again, the extent to which a statistical understanding of a demonstrable reduction in recidivism or other outcomes are required for all of our alcohol and drug treatment courts is actually a standing policy issue in this state. I don't think I can tell you confidently that all of our various treatment courts have that sort of data-driven set coming out at the end to I mean, this has been an issue in sessions past. So I don't know specifically about the ADISs or the Intoxicated Drivers Program Fund, if there's a certification process for those programs. Pulling back more generally, though, that is not a universal requirement.
Follow up. So I see the need for this, but I'm disturbed that we don't really seem to have an idea of what it would be.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Gorsuch, apologies that J.R.U. Jafusa is not with us today. He's the Multnomah County expert that works with us. He was on the phone during this work group discussion. I recall anecdotally that there were comments about the Multnomah County John School and the John School in Seattle that uses best practices, and there were comments along the lines of it being very effective in deterring future behaviors. And so I will say that came up in the conversation the day we had the work group meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Go
ahead.
My reading of this is that a court can order somebody into a diversion program, but the diversion program can be defined by the court, can they not? I mean, in Multnomah County, it would include the John School, but it necessarily in Grants County or Harney County.
Yeah, right here.
Could the court not define its own version of a diversion program?
Do you want to answer? Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, again, while there is some flex in the definition of John School, the fact of the John School would be a requirement by my reading.
Right.
So the court would be required to impose John School as a function of a diversion
not
under this section.
Not necessarily the Multnomah County John School.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlich, there's nothing in these amendments that require that the John School be in Multnomah County, correct?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just looking on there and not here, and I'm seeing really quick. Demand Forum is a national organization that provides John Schools. They go into great detail into exactly what the program is all about, the topics that are generally $400 for the diversion program itself, and right now it's available in 35 different cities. They also provide online courses and a DVD presentation.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, and thank you, Representative Olson, for bringing that up, because that was the thing, and I'm kind of tracking with Rep. Gorsuch here. I'd like to see something specifically written in here real clearly what that John School is, specific to what he just read, perhaps. So that's my first thought. But the main underlying thought that I've had here is, and I don't know if this is a question for you, Aaron, or perhaps the senator or the representative, do we have okay, the phrase shaming was used, maybe it was Representative Stark. Do we have, I wrote it down, do we have data on deterrence via shaming? And where I'm going with this is, I'd rather see a billboard on Gleason that says John Doe did sex trafficking. You see what I'm saying? That's a deterrent. I guarantee you that's a deterrent. I'd like to know numbers. Is taking away my fish and wildlife license, how is that shaming me? One. How is taking away my driver's license shaming me? Two. Because the only people are going to know is maybe my spouse and DMV. How is that deterring anybody? I don't see the deterrence here. I just see a lot of inconvenience, and that's fine. I want it to be inconvenient. But let's really go further with this, and let's do a billboard. And I'm being somewhat facetious, but you see where I'm going. I'd like to know if there's data that shows that this is deterrence.
Chair Barker and Representative Post, to your first comment, I would certainly be willing to put some definitional language into the bill, best practices or something like that for the John School. I'd hate to be too prescriptive because, as we've all seen, program best practices improve over time. And, you know, all of the talk today is about trauma-informed care and built around ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And we weren't talking too much about that 10 years ago. So I'd hate to be too prescriptive, but, you know, something along the line of today's best practices or something like that, I'm fine with that. As far as the licensure part, whether it's a hunting or a fishing license, yeah, possibly only your spouse or your kids or your local neighborhood might know, but this is getting to the individual themselves. If I'm an avid hunter, I'm probably going to think twice before I do something, whether it be poaching or prostitution or solicitation, before I do something that's going to risk losing something I love.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing I would say is, unless we do really big-time advertising that this is the consequence, which, to the point of poaching, I mean, there's signs everywhere. Anywhere you go in the state of Oregon, there's poaching is going to cost you this, a fine, your license, whatever. I'm not sure where the deterrent is because of the lack of advertising. I don't know how many people are going to know if this were to pass. How many people will know? So then is it a true deterrent versus my somewhat frivolous billboard idea?
Portland at one point was going to post names, and they got sued before they ever put them up and ended up making a big payout. So
I understand completely.
Representative Gorsuch.
The one thing to respond to Representative Post, there's, of course, the difference between specific deterrence, which is you get punished so much you won't ever do it again, which I think is where you're going, and general deterrence, which is you let everybody know so that then they're a spectacle in society. But it sounds like you're more interested in the specific sort of thing. Is that correct, Representative?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I would say all the above.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Barker, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that when we amended the bill, one of the things that happened was instead of losing your professional license, it's not that you lose your license, it's that it's reported to the licensing entity. So if you're a psychologist, then, and you were convicted, again, this is upon conviction, then the DOJ, you would be notified, the Board of Psychology would be notified that that license holder had received, was convicted of hiring a prostitute or any of the related crimes that are described here. And so, and then that board would be able to decide what to do. Just to remind everybody, of the different licensing boards that we have here in the state, there are different tolerance levels for different things. So if you have been convicted, for example, for a DUI, one entity, I don't want to name any specific board over another because I don't have the facts in front of me, but they're different, especially with the medical professional boards. It's handled differently. So there already is, I don't want to say use the word precedent in front of the Judiciary Committee, but there is already some actions where boards make some determinations, and they get to decide what they want to do or how they want to handle it. Did I say that correctly?
Okay. And so we're going to need to get going, moving along here.
Yes, of course.
And what I believe what I will be doing today is not moving the bill today. We're going to maybe see if we can't find a place to put a definition of John's school somewhere else, and then this one will trail that.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to just remind the committee about consequences. If a person is convicted of a sex crime, in this case convicted of soliciting, they're barred from teaching for life. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty significant consequence for this.
The consequences, I will just remind us all of the usual underage or very young woman who gets caught up in this is horrific as well. So
yeah, we're not talking about underage in this case. We're talking about any solicitation.
Yeah, right. We are talking about any, but it's usually not old women that are doing this.
No.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, panel.
Okay, thank you.
Call up Gail Meyer, Senator Dembro, and Julie. And we do need to, I have a lot of bills today, so I appreciate you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, House colleagues. Gosh, you are a lot of people up here. Far fewer in the morning. I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the Senator for District 23. That's Northeast, Southeast Portland. And I'm here because I want to put a concern on the record about this bill. And it comes out of my experience with the Task Force on Reentry in Housing and Employment, which I sat on with Representative Parrish and Senator Winter, and at the time, Representative, now Senator Lou Frederick. And one of the issues that came up as we were looking at the obstacle that people who are formerly incarcerated face is challenges with losing their licenses and not having their driver's license and then not being able to work or to provide for their families, et cetera. And what we discovered in the work of the task force was, okay, on the one hand, there's been a growing movement of adding driver's license suspensions for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with driving. But it's just a penalty that the state can impose on people. And there's also now, a counter movement because there's concern that this is going overboard. And nationwide, some 40% of all driver's license suspensions are due to reasons that have nothing to do with driving. And this tends to fall heaviest on people of low income and communities of color who tend to be in this position. And so there's been a movement that's been sponsored by the Association of Directors of Motor Vehicles that driver's license suspensions be limited to offenses that have to do with driving. State of Washington recently passed legislation to do that. They called their bill the Driving While Poor Bill to try to free people from what becomes an impossible cycle of poverty due to loss of license. We in the Senate have a bill that is about to come out of judiciary. It's Senate Bill 693 that I'm co-sponsoring with Senator Winters, and it comes out of our work group work as well. So I'll turn it over to Representative Parrish. I think she'll have more to add on this subject. I just ask you to really add a note of caution as to whether driver's license suspension is really the appropriate and necessary penalty to be putting on this particular offense.
It doesn't curtail a second time. The first one's diversion.
Or the first time if they, for whatever reason, can't do diversion.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin. And I also want to state a concern about adding a revocation of driver's license or privileges around driving for crimes that do not have a nexus to driving. Most of you have heard or understand I come from a family that doesn't always follow the law. And no one can probably ever put me in the soft on crime camp, but I do believe in forgiveness in the law. And part of that is once somebody has done their time, we need them to be able to come out and be productive members of society. In talking with our own justice system in Clackamas County, one of the things that's really interesting is that when you do send somebody out of our justice system and they don't have the ability to get to things like parole and probation, and they live out in Estacada when there's no transportation system, they face a choice. They can either drive to that meeting in Oregon City so that they can be there for a UA, or they can meet with their officer for compliance, or they can skip that and have the sheriff come out and pick them up and put them into jail because they are out of compliance, and there's a cost associated with that. And so for us, one of the things that, you know, in our task force we learned, and I just knew from first experience with siblings, was that we have people who will never pay off their DMV fees. I've talked to women in Coffee Creek who say, you know, I've got $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 of DMV fees. And I've literally had conversations with women inside those walls who have said, you know, I have thought about, you know, what one last crime would I commit so I could get some money so that I could pay off my driver's license. I don't think that's what we want, colleagues. And so I really do have concerns if this is not a DUI type offense, if it's not some sort of, you know, criminal driving. You know, the other piece of this is that they choose to go to that parole probation meeting and they're driving and they don't have a license, you know, eventually they get into that felony driving while suspended. And that is a vicious, vicious cycle that puts more court fees, it puts more DMV fees, and you just never get out of that. And when you're talking about people coming out of the justice system who are trying to reconnect with their families, this is just an incredible hardship, and I would just urge us to not stack more on these folks. If they've done their crime and they've done their time, it should not include, if there was a non-vehicular, non-auto related, it shouldn't include permanently taking away or suspending those licenses or putting on so many fees that it is just onus for them to get that.
If they're driving to engage in the prostitution, would that...
I would not call that a in-your-car crime. I think the crime that you're trying to address there is the sex crime piece of that. And again, you know, you think about a lot of the women in that who are there because they are roped into bad relationships, or, you know, really that they see that as the only way to move and advance their life forward. I don't think we should criminalize them with a driver's license issue.
Ms. Myers.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd like to hearken the committee's memory back to the opening hearing that we had on 2141, 2142. There was discussion about the Nordic model of eliminating the demand for sex trafficking. And part of that model was to engage in public opprobrium and shame. And that we had quite an active discussion about that. I'd like to point out this bill only applies to the crime of commercial sexual solicitation. So this is your adult-to-adult decision to engage in sex for a fee. This is not relating to minors. This is not relating to force. This is not relating to compelling or trafficking. This is, by its mere statutory definition, two consenting adults agreeing to engage in sex for a fee. So under our current laws, so again, with respect to the licensure revocation, if you don't really have a nexus, and then also with respect to the revocation of the fish and wildlife licensing tags, et cetera. We currently have a requirement on the probationary side that any conditions that a court imposes for probation have to be reasonably related to the commission of the criminal conduct. So if a judge, but for this bill here, but if a judge on were to issue a probationary sanction on someone and to say, and I'm going to revoke your fish and wildlife licenses, that would be reversed on appeal because it's just not related to the crime. So the question really presented is, legislatively, should this body mandate that some of these unrelated collateral consequences apply as a matter of conviction? Getting to the issue of, is this your first conviction, your second conviction? It could be your first time that you're stopped for this. It could be happening if you are your very first arrest and prosecution. If you elect to go to trial and you lose, that would be your conviction. If you, on your very first time, went through diversion and for some reason you didn't complete your diversion program successfully for any number of reasons, that would be your first conviction. If this body truly wants to make this a second conviction type offense or second conviction type consequence, you'd frame it differently. You would say that that at the time they committed the current crime, they had a prior conviction. So that's how that would read if you truly wanted to get into a second conviction cycle. It would have to read differently.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and just, since we're not going to move the bill today, we'll go ahead.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Is there a particular day you want to move it over to? Thursday.
And also make an announcement today. We're planning on having a Thursday evening meeting as well as a Friday meeting.
Sorry.
To try to catch up, we'll be meeting probably Thursday evening.
Do you want to announce we'll roll over the work session?
And we're going to roll over the work session on this till Thursday on the current bill. Opening public hearing on House Bill 2175. If we can get it all done Thursday night, we won't have a Friday meeting. So I'm hoping to wrap up.
Chair Parker.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Do you want to do 2175 and 76 at the same time?
Sure. Open 2176 as well.
All right. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. So I'm going to give you a quick history on sober centers and what's happened in this building in the last couple of years regarding them and where we're at with these bills today. So in 2015, Wally Hicks convinced me that a great idea was to have a three-word fix to allow a sober center to come into existence in Grants Pass, Oregon. 22 amendments later, we figured out how to do that. Thank you, former Representative Wally Hicks. So what is a sober center? A sober center is a safe place for a person who is acutely intoxicated, who has become a danger to themselves or others, to sober up. That's what a sober center is for. And the issue that we had run into and that many communities have run into is that public intoxication is not against the law. And so if an officer comes along somebody who is, you know, intoxicated to the point that they are a danger to self and others, they are legally bound to do something with that individual. And they can't take them to jail because, well, they haven't committed a crime. So where do they take them without a sober center? They take them to the hospital. And that is a very, very expensive place to take them. In addition to that, it's not necessarily the best place for them because once they get there, what ends up happening is the crisis unit or whoever's making the phone calls in a mental health professional who then comes in and will typically have to spend hours waiting for that person to sober up before they can even attempt to assess this person as to whether they are a danger to self or others. So we proposed the idea of sobering centers. There were three that were already in existence when we proposed this idea. Those three had really strong relationships already with detox facilities. But there's a significant difference between a detox facility and a sober center.
Sober centers, maximum 24 hours you can be there so that you don't hit a detox phase point in as you are sobering. And they also don't provide any treatment. Okay, it is truly a spot for them to sober up. So what people in general were very positive on this concept of sober centers, but the issue came when we got into how do we deal with immunity for these. The existing sober facilities enjoyed kind of the shadow of immunity under the detox facilities and that allowed a level of malice immunity. And as we communicated with members in and outside of this building, the trial lawyers and so forth, to discover that really that was a very strong standard for these facilities. And so we grandfathered in our House Bill 2936 in 2015, we grandfathered in the three existing facilities and then at that level of immunity. And then for any new ones, we said, let's take that down a notch. Let's make it gross negligent. That's more appropriate. And let's make sure that there is good oversight or regulation of this. Well, how do you regulate this? And so through a great partnership with the Trial Lawyers Association, we came up with language to say a few things. This is how we would watch over this. First, we said that these facilities, in order to be, would have to register with Oregon Health Authority. And to become a facility, they would have to be in partnership with a treatment facility of some sort. And we defined that in the original bill a bit. And we said that they would have to follow best practices on this. And we said, you know what? This is something new. This is a new model. Let's limit the number of these that can actually register. Let's actually watch it for a couple years and see how it works before we open it up statewide. And that's where we're at today. Okay, it has worked incredibly well. Josephine County has launched theirs with the Grants Pass Sober Facility. I can give you all kinds of details there. In fact, I know it well enough that as you see on your desk there, there's a picture. I went ahead and spent a dry night at the facility. Because, and I asked them, I showed up actually at the police department. They would not handcuff me, but they did put me in the back of the car, drove me down there to take me all the way through the entire process, stayed the entire night there. They did everything with me, according to they claim, that they would do with anybody else. So I wouldn't know what they actually went through. This is a well-oiled machine. They know what they're doing. And they said that really roughly 50% of the people coming in are actually self-referring. Where they discover I've drank too much or I'm intoxicated on one thing or another and I need help. And they said somewhere around 30% of them are actually taking the next step to get some sort of additional treatment and help. Because every single person before they check out the next day, they have a mental health professional who comes and does an assessment with them, talks to them, and then they have exit counseling to talk about what got you here and what can you do next. And they said that roughly 30% of those people are actually taking the next step to go get some sort of help. So we're super excited about how well this is running. Because of that, right now, and we'll have a report in just a moment from OHA, in fact, you might want to come on up. You know, one of the things we said is that OHA would give a report back to the legislature in the 2017 session to let you guys know how it's going. So you have that report on OLIS, called Sobering Facilities. This is their report back that they've sent us. And so we're at the point where we have one facility who has registered, two more that have been identified that are still in process, but they have to be far enough along the lines as far as their physical facility to register. And lo and behold, many people throughout the state, as you'll hear in a couple minutes, are eager to start these. So the bills in front of you that we're talking about today, House Bill 2175 says, you know what, we can lift the cap. Trial lawyers submitted a letter. They said, hey, this is working well. You know, let's lift the cap. Let's make this so if a county wants to do this and they're ready to and they can follow the guidelines, then absolutely let's do it. One other thing we modified in there is just the communication between the facility registering and OHA. There was a little mix-up when we were doing that the first round, and so we just wanted to clarify that would be by certified mail. So that's two things there. The other bill is might sound a little strange, but these facilities take money. I guess that does sound strange, huh? These days, everything takes money. So House Bill 2178 basically says that out of the drug and alcohol money that is sent from OHA to the counties, that counties may, OHA may allow it, and counties may, big words there, use those for so up to 10% of those for sobering facilities. Now, I'm well aware that if you take money from one spot and put it in another, then, well, there's competition there. The point here is to allow local communities to take a look at the money that's coming in, take a look at their entire treatment spectrum, and say, does this warrant some of that money? And if so, let's figure out how we do that within the resources that are already coming in, because that might be a good part of the overall model of the continuum of care. So at this point, if you guys will allow me, we'll have OHA give their quick report back, and then we'll open up for questions before other testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Tamara McNatt, and I'm the Licensing and Certification Unit Lead for Health Systems Division of the Oregon Health Authority. As Representative Stark was mentioning, pursuant to the 2015 House Bill 2936, the Oregon Health Authority registered the three existing sobering facilities prior to the deadline listed in the bill of December 31st, 2015. Central City Concern of Portland registered that August. Buckley Sobering Services of Eugene registered that September, and then Moore Center in Medford registered that December of 2015. In addition, and also pursuant to that bill, the Oregon Health Authority was allowed to register three new sobering centers or facilities, which three have been identified. The Grants Pass Sobering Center did register a year ago in April of 2016, and they are currently operational. Klamath County's sobering facility has run into some delays with the winter weather these past few months, and the last information known to me was that they were going to start construction this month in April 2017. However, they are committed to moving forward once they're able to break ground for that construction. And then the contract for the Douglas County sobering facility was signed by ADAPT on March 20th and by OHA on March 23rd of this year. So they are committed in holding the contract. However, ADAPT will be subcontracting out for the delivery of the sobering facility services to a local community provider. The last known entity was UCAN, the United Community Action Network, but that information may have to be confirmed for that. So in summary, there are the four currently operational registered facilities with two in various stages of the process. The Health Systems Division does find that these sobering facilities are viable alternatives to both incarceration and emergency room visits, in which they also offer that community resource tool for when individuals are ready to integrate back in their communities, which has proven to be very successful.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Right. Oh, yes. Representative Greenlick.
Roughly how much does it cost to operate a sobering center?
Thank you, Vice Chair Williamson and Representative Greenlick. The Grants Pass Sobering Center, last I touched base with them, it was roughly $250,000 a year to operate, and they have 12 beds there.
Thank you.
And Representative Williamson, if I may, just to offer, there are a number of individuals throughout the state who offered to come testify today, knowing we would be crunched for time. Many of them submitted letters for you to read instead. And so please make sure you spend some time to read those.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Leininger.
Thank you, Chair Williamson. Representative Stark, I just want to compliment you. I had the pleasure of serving on the Judiciary Committee when you brought this forward initially, and you spent a lot of time working on the concept together with the team, including OHA and all the other good people who are advocates for this. But it's been a really great thing to watch, and I think it's been an important success, and I hope you I just want to compliment you on your hard work and the team's hard work and effectiveness.
Chair Barker, Rep. Leininger, thank you for that compliment. There are so many people who work together. I mean, OTLA and, you know, especially Chief Landis and Rick Jones out of Grants Pass, Oregon Health Authority, Sarah Lochner. I mean, so many people who really went a long ways to put in a ton of effort to make this work. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so Chief Jerry Moore, Sheriff Jason Myers, Tim Murphy, please. Just remember to identify yourself when you...
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Jerry Moore. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Salem, and I appreciate you giving us the time to speak today. As you may guess, I'm here to support House Bills 2175 and 2176, which would add additional sobering centers and potential funding to centers throughout the state of Oregon. And while I'm representing the City of Salem today, I do want to tell you that I know I in the discussions I have with local chiefs and sheriffs that I represent a lot of their interest as well in our region. Sobering stations have long been a need in the Salem area. I've worked there a long time, and I can tell you we've never, except for small periods of time, had sobering stations available to us. And as you leave here during the day, I'm sure as you drive through Salem, you can see that we are a destination many times for people that are in need of assistance. They are addicted, and they have needs that, quite frankly, our overloaded public safety and social service agencies are unable to fill. And one of those is, of course, the need for a sobering station, which, as Representative Stark indicated, many times ends up being a jail or a hospital, which is the last place that that should occur. I do want to tell you on the positive side, I believe we have a very positive community who's ready to step up and look for solutions to issues such as this. And I know that the need for a sobering center has been on many of their minds for quite some time. And I will cut this short and say that I know that the great partnerships we have with our sheriff's office and our social service agencies will help us move forward. And we feel these bills will be the impetus for us to be able to perhaps in the very near future have a sobering station that can serve this region. So thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Sure.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jason Myers, Marion County Sheriff, and I just echo what the chief has to say. Very supportive of both of these House bills. As you know, I've been before you to testify on the array of services we have here in Marion County, especially around behavioral health. This is one big void that we have as a sobering center. And so these bills would be vehicles to help us get towards that goal. Representative Stark, I'm about ready to swear him in. He hit the nail on the head in terms of continuum of services and how important sobering is to getting somebody down the road to recovery. So kudos to everybody that's worked on this and to your education around this issue, because it is an important issue. And as you know, co-occurring disorders between behavioral health and addiction, they run part and parcel. And so having resources to be able to assess and then determine the best a facility for an individual that can get community services, we're far better ahead than sending them into the criminal justice system, as the chief mentioned. Tim Murphy's here from Bridgeway, one of our service providers. We have a local effort ongoing now with the City of Salem, Mayor Bennett, the county. We're engaging the Salem Hospital, the CCO. We're bringing all of the stakeholders together for a development of a strategic plan and funding to fund this center. And these bills would help us, obviously, with the liability issue, as well as maybe some seed money for a facility. So, again, very supportive, and just know that this would help us tremendously in the efforts that we have with the population that we serve. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Chair Barker and members of the commission, my name is Tim Murphy. I'm the chief executive officer of Bridgeway Recovery Services, which is a substance use disorder clinic and mental health clinic here in Salem. I have the privilege of being with two of my community partners, and we work collaboratively together in the community, serving people that are struggling with symptoms of mental illness and chemical dependency. And I also want to echo both the chief and the sheriff's comments about Representative Stark. You actually did a better job than, and I think I can talk about this pretty well, but you really outlined every aspect that's necessary and needed. What I see at Bridgeway are people struggling in our medically managed withdrawal or detox clinic, and also people in treatment. And when they, if they're lucky enough to arrive and receive services in detox or treatment, and we hear about the stories of when they were publicly picked up and intoxicated, and they often end up in emergency rooms, plugging up emergency rooms. Salem Hospital has one of the longest wait times in an emergency room in the state, one of the busiest emergency rooms in the state. And to offload this population into an appropriate center like a sobering station would be beneficial to both the hospital, the public, and the people receiving service. And the same thing with our community jails. Our jails do not need to be plugged up with people as a result of public intoxication. They need to be served by people that can serve them, and we have those people. So I urge you as well, as the chief did and the sheriff did, to be in support of these two measures so we can move forward in offering sobering stations around the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next I'll call Sheriff Nelson, Cheryl Ramirez, and John Eames. And we are a little short of time, so I appreciate the condense. Please go ahead and remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thanks. Shane Nelson, Deschutes County Sheriff. Chair Barker, honorable members of the committee, I really appreciate your time. One of the things about going after a wonderful crew is you don't have anything else to say. So I'm going to keep it really short. I'm no mental health expert. I'm no substance abuse expert. I am a sheriff that oversees a jail, and I'll tell you right now that that's where we take care of those folks, is in our jail, and we do the best we can. We're fortunate in Deschutes County, where we are three-quarters of the way to having our crisis stabilization center sober station become a reality. The sheriff's office there alone has invested $550,000 into this facility, as well as health services. It's a partnership between the two organizations. With expanded immunity for this center, we can make it a reality, and I'll guarantee you that. And the whole point of a facility like this is to get those who want help, get them some help, and have them be productive citizens of this community. We can't always save someone from themselves, but we're going to do the best job that we can. If you'll vote to support that immunity, that facility will become a reality and we'll see great things. I very much appreciate your time, and I want to leave you with one example. We have a jail diversion program in our county, and we had a particular inmate who could not stay out of jail longer than 30 days at a time. This particular inmate has not darkened our doorway of our Deschutes County Jail for 160 days. The inmate was afflicted with mental health issues and substance abuse issues. And through this jail diversion program, this inmate sought services through his peers, and we were able to keep him out of our facility. It's not only the right thing to do, but if you look at it strictly from dollars and cents, it's a savings to the taxpayer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here on behalf of the Community Mental Health Programs to express our support for both House Bills 2175 and 2176. Sobering centers present a much-needed alternative to jails and hospitals for the crisis service providers and for law enforcement to take people to who are acutely intoxicated. It's certainly an option we want all counties to have for a person to go through sobering and also for a safe place for under 24 hours to be. Sobering centers serve a distinct purpose, and they are not a substitute for treatment, as Representative Stark mentioned in his testimony. We want to make sure that expansion of sobering centers doesn't come at the cost of reducing and reallocating a very, very small bucket for substance use disorder treatment. So that's the only thing we're concerned about, but we're totally for more sobering centers. I think that because there's a very big intersection between public safety and behavioral health in for sobering centers, that we need to work across our systems to coordinate their care and to make sure that we can find creative solutions to braid the funding needed to build and maybe renovate and operate sobering centers beyond the funds delineated in House Bill 2176. I know I've seen those proposals, including Deschutes and Klamath, and they need way more money to build and operate those sobering centers than what is provided for in House Bill 2176. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on the behalf of the Oregon Prevention Education and Recovery Association, otherwise known as OPRA, which is the statewide trade association representing alcohol and drug treatment here in Oregon. Once again, as we did in previous legislative sessions, thank you to Representative Stark for bringing these bills forward. We worked very hard on these bills, and it's been quite a trip to be able to get it across the finish line, and we have. I echo Ms. Ramirez's comments. We are strongly supportive of these bills, and we hope that more investment into treatment as well as sobering centers can occur this legislative session, even in this most challenging budget environment. So we will work to do that and work to support you, Representative Stark, on these bills. So thank you for bringing them forward.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on those bills, and we're going to roll over until Tuesday to do the work session to get our paperwork caught up. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2794.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2794 reduces the crime of possession of gambling records in the second degree to a Class B misdemeanor. There is, however, an amendment. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the measure, modifies the crime of unauthorized use of a vehicle. The modification requires that the conduct occur knowingly without the consent of the owner and with slight corroborative evidence of the absence of the owner's consent. The amendment defines slight corroborative evidence, and it maintains the elements relating to knowingly riding in another's vehicle without the owner's consent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Call Ryan Lucan, and Mary Sell, you may as well come up as well. So we.
And good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Lufkin, L-U-F-K-I-N. I am a district attorney with Multnomah County, and I'm here to testify in support of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2794. This is a bill that would correct a problem that occurred at the Court of Appeals level as they interpreted your unlawful use of a vehicle statute. That is the primary statute by which we prosecute people who are stealing cars or driving around in stolen cars. The problem occurred in State v. Korth and State v. Ship. These are 2014 and 2015 Court of Appeals opinions. They changed the understanding and the landscape under which we had been prosecuting these stolen vehicles, specifically with what amount of proof is necessary for the state to establish that the defendant knew that he was driving or using a stolen vehicle. In Korth, what was determined to be not enough evidence was that the driver of a stolen vehicle reported to police that Dave the Transient gave him the car, that he had no idea where Dave the Transient lived or how to contact Dave, that jiggle keys, which are shaved keys to operate stolen vehicles, were present in the vehicle, that drugs were in the vehicle, and that the defendant lied to police. What the Court of Appeals said is that that is not sufficient for any jury anywhere to convict this defendant for having used a vehicle without the consent of the owner. That is the problem. In Ship, what was found insufficient was that the defendant possessed methamphetamine in the vehicle, got the vehicle from a guy named Richie, bolt cutters, multiple keys, documents with other people's names on them, and my personal favorite, a locked case that was specifically labeled, quote, crime committing kit, end quote, was in the vehicle, along with other stolen property, damage to the vehicle, and the defendant was not using the correct key to operate the vehicle. These facts were determined to be not sufficient for any jury in the entire state to be entitled to convict this defendant for driving a stolen vehicle. It was not enough proof to prove that the defendant knew that the vehicle they were driving was stolen. Downstream, how have these cases impacted the trial court? This is a quote from Judge Henry Cantor, who heard the case of State v. Alains. If there is no additional evidence, would I have any great difficulty finding the defendant guilty of these charges? Not particularly. But the Court of Appeals says I can't do that, as far as I can tell. They have put a shackle on the state, as far as I can tell, in trying to prove these cases. It seems like the burden of knowledge for a stolen motor vehicle is nearly impossible for the state to meet without the defendant's own words or close to it or much more extravagant facts. State v. Ivey was a trial heard just a few months ago in front of Judge Eric Bergstrom, who said, quote, the state of unlawful use of a motor vehicle law may be absurd to some of us, but it is the state of unlawful use of motor vehicle law. These are examples of cases that we could not prosecute because of a reasonable application of this Court of Appeals case law. Driver of a motor vehicle said that he bought the car off the internet for $500 from a stranger that he had no way of contacting as his explanation for why he was driving a stolen vehicle. Driver of a stolen vehicle said he purchased the car from his cousin Jerry for $200 and was given a wad of keys to figure out which one worked. Driver of the stolen vehicle lied about her name, said she obtained the vehicle from, quote, David, a person she had no contact information for, and lied about David because while she saw David driving the car 3 weeks ago, the car was stolen 24 hours ago.
and driver of the stolen vehicle was using switch license plates, lied about where he bought the vehicle, in possession of drugs, and had recently been arrested for, in fact, driving a stolen vehicle. What has this resulted in? Here are the statistics. From 2013 to 2015, Multnomah County has seen an increase of 20% in the reported rate of stolen vehicles. However, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office has declined issuing in more than 20%. So the rate of decrease of our ability to actually issue charges has been 20%, while the crime rate for this offense has gone up by 20%. That's a 40% differential in what should be occurring, which is people who get arrested for stolen vehicles should ordinarily have their charges issued. Why is this not a problem anywhere else? Well, in every jurisdiction that surrounds us, that is not how the case law has been interpreted. What has been the case from common law historically forward and in these other jurisdictions is summarized by this quote I found from the Third Circuit in 1970. We need not catalog the large number of cases holding that unexplained possession of recently stolen goods raises a presumption or warrants an inference of guilty possession. How has this been applied? In Washington State, once a person that rode in a motor vehicle that was taken without the consent, slight corroborative evidence is all that is necessary to establish guilty knowledge. Absence of plausible explanation is a corroborating circumstance. Flight from police is a corroborative circumstance. That's a case from 1999 out of Washington State. From 2015, Washington State, merely being in possession of stolen property is insufficient to support a conviction, but possession of stolen property coupled with slight corroborative evidence is sufficient to prove guilty knowledge. California, mere possession of stolen car under suspicious circumstances is sufficient to sustain a conviction. Possession of recently stolen property is so incriminating that to warrant a conviction for unlawful taking, there need only be, in addition to possession, slight corroboration in the form of statements or conduct of the defendant tending to show guilt. Where recently stolen property is found in the conscious possession of the defendant, who upon being questioned by police gives a false explanation regarding his possession or remains silent under circumstances indicating consciousness of guilt, an inference of guilt is permissible. California. And in Idaho, the statute reads, any person who shall have in his possession or knows or has reason to believe has been stolen shall be guilty of a felony. So what is my proposed solution? Well, I think we just need to go towards where that other those other jurisdictions have landed, and frankly, where the vast weight of historical precedent has landed. Adopt the same standard. Use the phrase, as has been used in courts and our sister jurisdictions, slight corroborative evidence. Define that for the Court of Appeals, which has already gone so far down a path that has made it impossible for us to prosecute these offenses that we need to be a little bit more specific in what we mean by this offense, and state, as it does in the Dash 1 amendments, that to constitute this crime requires that the defendant be knowingly operating a vehicle, that that is being done without the permission of the owner, and that there is, in fact, slight corroborative evidence of the lack of consent for that owner. And I've created a list of what those types of things are, just as you saw in some of those cases, flight from police, absence of plausible explanation, those forms of things. That is what will correct this problem, and it is a growing problem throughout the state. We're not going to be able to correct this in the weight of all of that case law from the Court of Appeals. So we really are reliant on you to kind of course correct this statute so that we can get back to where we were prior to these cases. And just to be very clear, one of the things that often comes up with stolen vehicle cases is there's a way of charging a person who is a passenger of a stolen vehicle as having committed this crime. The Dash 1 Amendment does not change the current law for passengers. We've carved them out and put them in a different subsection that maintains the current case law. This bill is not intended to do anything with passengers. It's talking about people who are in actual possession driving stolen vehicles around. That's where we're having problems. And what I would like to conclude with in saying is that this population of offenders, as has been in my experience, are constant recidivists. They cycle in and out of the jail on stolen vehicle charges. They learn what works and what doesn't. We have multiple instances of them sharing information with one another to know what to say to the officer when they get pulled over in the stolen vehicle. This is why it becomes a bigger and bigger problem over time. It's already well known among our recidivist population how to get out of these things, and it's only going to become more problematic. So we're hoping for this change, and thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. Please, Mary.
Hi, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I am a legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I am here opposing this bill. The first thing that I want to highlight is clearly this is a gut and stuff bill, and this bill was posted this morning at 9:24 a.m. What we want to put on the record is this type of substantive change in the law that is the type that inevitably requires a deeper conversation between stakeholders, and we were never apprised of this information. Mr. Lufkin has a PowerPoint presentation that I'm assuming takes some time to put together, and so there was probably enough time to write us an email. And so I just want to put that out there that in the future we would like to at least be part of a substantive conversation when substantive law is being changed. Thankfully, I was able to speak to my legislative committee, and we are OCDLA is in opposition for two reasons. The first regards the mental state, and two regards the new element of slight corroborating evidence. First, regarding the mental state, case law already supports the idea that the state must prove the mental state of knowledge. And the case law is clear that this is the mental state, and so we believe that the proposed change in this law is not actually necessary. Two, the new element regarding the slight corroborating evidence, there are essentially three things that I want to lay out. The first is, in any case, in a criminal matter, the state has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. By rewriting the law, we see this as them attempting to lower their burden and shift the burden. And the second point is they're taking away the jury's discretion. The credibility of the evidence, the weight of the evidence, what the evidence indicates is solely the purview of the jury by law. In a criminal case, the judge must instruct the jury on how they consider the evidence. These factors in this bill are circumstantial evidence that the jury gets to base their verdict on. These types of factors still get to go to the jury as circumstantial evidence if the judge believes that there is, if they're reasonable. And I'll go to the case law in a minute. So as far as circumstantial evidence goes, the proof of a chain of circumstances pointing to the existence or non-existence of a certain fact, the jury may base their verdict on circumstantial evidence. So ultimately, if this can go to the jury, they get to decide that. Lastly, and probably most importantly, we're opposed to the state adding in this element because it comments on the evidence. By rewriting the law itself is commenting on what the jury is supposed to be considering and why. That actually matters a lot in criminal law. In the User's Guide to the Uniform Criminal Jury Instructions, it actually outlines case law that explains to the judge when determining what kind of jury instruction to give, that it prohibits the judge from commenting on the probative value of the evidence. Case law says the judge shall not instruct with respect to matters of fact, nor comments thereon. A comment on the evidence is an instruction on the probative value of the evidence. A court impermissibly comments on the evidence when it gives a jury instruction that tells the jury how specific evidence relates to a particular legal issue. Any language, therefore, that provides a hint of the court's own evaluation of the evidence should be avoided. If you look at the proposed law, the new element is absolutely a comment on the evidence. Instructing the jury to make an inference how the evidence relates to the mental state and what the state has to prove. If written this way, I can imagine and believe that our practitioners will litigate this. So we are opposed to this bill. We would like to have been consulted or apprised. We believe that a discussion at this point, there might not be enough time to do so, and so we're asking you not to move the bill. Regarding the cases in that Mr. Lufkin brought up, State v. Korth, in those cases, the Court of Appeals said, regarding Korth, the evidence in this case, quote, requires the stacking of inferences to the point of speculation. When we're talking about a criminal trial, the evidence that goes to the jury has to be of the type that a reasonable fact finder would be able to find the defendant guilty. It is ultimately up to them to decide whether or not what weight and credibility to give the evidence. But in this case, while some of the evidence might be laughable in the context of what is a trial court going to do and is that information going to go to the jury, they do have to make that determination. And so our position is that there's not a problem, and our position is that we're in extreme opposition. Thank you.
And so the game rules changed with the Court of Appeals decision. Prior to that, those kind of things were in there in other states. And so we don't have the paperwork today. We can't move the this bill today, so I'm going to close the public hearing and roll this over till tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to roll over the work session of House Bill 2308, 2740, 2171, mm-hmm. and 2630 until tomorrow, and call Whitney back up for right there. Okay. We're open a work session in a moment here.
For 2597?
Yeah. The committee stand at ease for just a minute. Committee's back in session. I'm going to roll House Bill 2597 over until tomorrow as well. Any further business to come before the large, happy committee?
Okay.
We will stand adjourned for it. Thank you. We will stand adjourned for it. Thank you.